I wanted to talk now about the other female in this room, and she's everywhere. This one over here is a painting from, it's in our shrine at Shasta Abbey, in our main Buddha hall, and was painted by one of our monks. Let's see. Oh, I'm looking. This one up here is probably one of the most, it's the most frequent sort of image that you will see of her. But she appears in all these various forms. Originally, she was known as Avalokiteshvara in India. That's her Sanskrit name. The name means the Lord who sees. When Buddhism went to China, she gradually transformed into a woman. And in India, she always appeared as a male. So hence the Lord who sees. And there's actually a book on this table called Guan Yin, which is her name in Chinese. And that's what I'm going to call her, because the Chinese are the most consistent about rendering her as a female. But that book, it's got a blue cover, talks about her transition from a male into a female and how that happened in China and why it happened. And that can be an interesting story to read. It also is a bit long and scholarly, so beware. So, as I said, when Buddhism moved to China around by the year 1000, and you know, the Buddha lived about 500 BC. Buddhism came to China about the time of the birth of Christ, and by the year 1000, he was a she, and appears in these many forms. Her name, Guan Yin, means to hear or regard the sounds. And her longer name, Guan Yin Shi, means to hear or regard the cries of the world. And you often hear her described as she who hears the cries of the world. And she is the embodiment of compassion. So we've had wisdom before the tea break, and now we have compassion. And wisdom and compassion are the foundation of Mahayana Buddhism, which is the form of Buddhism that we practice. It's a huge school of Buddhism that includes China, Japan, Korea, Tibet, and now us. And this afternoon, by the way, we'll be talking more about Buddhism in the West and how it is shifting and could shift and change as it appears in the West and bumps up against our own relationship to gender. So when Guan Yin, or Buddhism, went from China to Korea to Japan, Guan Yin went essentially as a female, but you will also find male images of her in Japan and Korea. And so I think of her as primarily female, and in the West we tend to think of compassion as female. However, in Tibetan Buddhism, wisdom is female and compassion is male. So some of this is cultural, which I think is interesting. And so I think of her as a wonderful example of this kind of shape changing, changing of form, where male and female become fluid and flexible and shift into each other and become one another. You know, and I think that ultimately, as men and women, we do become one another. You know, we do become the wholeness that is the two genders coming together. And in that wholeness, we ultimately leave gender behind. And my own sense is that the solution to the issue of gender is not either male or female, but some coming together of the two in a transcendent whole that includes both and accommodates both. And I think that that's what Buddhism points to. I think that would be the Buddhist position on gender. Except that in Buddhism, it's very dangerous to take a position because Prajnaparamita will come and knock it out from under you. Now, Kanzan, Guanyin, she's known as Kanzan in Japan. So, you don't have to remember all these names. I'm going to try to be consistent and call her Guanyin. But she has another name in Japanese, which is Kanjizai. Kanjizai. It's close to Kanzan. Kanjizai. And it's very interesting because Kanjizai means contemplating self-existence, which means, you know, here's me, my separate self. Contemplating self-existence and realizing freedom in perceiving its emptiness. So contemplating self-existence and realizing freedom in perceiving its emptiness. So already you can see that compassion is not disconnected from wisdom, but from shunyata, the wisdom of Prajnaparamita. And I'll try to, and if I forget to do this, stop me, but I want to try to, at some point, draw the connection between that rendition of her name and the rendition of her name, She Who Hears the Cries of the World. Now, compassion, I want to talk a little bit about compassion and the form of compassion that she represents. Because I think it's easy for us to be a little bit ooey-gooey about compassion. And, you know, well, we won't go there right now. I was just thinking that I kind of grew up as a tomboy, so I'm a little bit confused about gender things. And so ooey gooey starts to make me nervous, but that's just my thing. let me back up one step and just say that Kanzan, unlike Prajnaparamita, who is so obscure and invisible in a sense, Kanzan is actually very visible. She is one of the most venerated images in all of Buddhism after the Buddha. You know, I mean, first we have the Buddha, and that's central. But after that, she's everywhere. And I mean, and you all know probably that you find her in garden shops and in knick-knack shops and in bookstores. She's over there. She's all around. Yeah, this great big one, I missed it earlier. I didn't think of it, but that's actually totally epitomizes how she's rendered. And it's a really classic example of Guanyin and how she's rendered. And she, you'll often see her with this vase pouring water. What she's doing is pouring the water of compassion on all beings, which is really a lovely image. Compassion, she's known as the bodhisattva of compassion who will take any form in order to help beings. So the compassion that she has is a compassion that empathizes with beings suffering or pain or distress, knows our stress, understands it, and can empathize with it, feel it. Compassion actually means to feel with. And then beyond that, to do something about it, to attempt to help beings. And the legends about her are about the various forms that she takes in order to help beings, including forms that we might consider to be less spiritual, like being a prostitute or a thief. And to a certain extent, you know, this can help us see the teaching in things that happen to us that we don't appreciate. That actually they can be things that we find difficult, that we don't like, that causes pain, actually can have this compassion embedded within them if we don't get stuck on this isn't the help I wanted, and it's not in the form I wanted. You know, and we could be very opinionated about how we wanted our help to come. But if we let those opinions open up a little bit, we can actually see help in places where we wouldn't have expected it. So there's this empathizing with suffering and this ability to do something about it. And that ability to do something about it is often called upaya, or skillful means. Skillful means, finding a skillful way to help people. Now, most of the images in this room are of her looking like a more or less ordinary female human being, but she takes other forms, and we don't have many examples of them, but there is one. That top postcard over there is an image of her with, I think, 11 heads. I didn't count the heads. 11 heads and 1,000 arms. And you'll often see her with 4, 8, 32, or 1,000, 100, 1,000 arms. And she's often referred to as the one with 1,000 hands and 1,000 eyes. In the palm of each hand is an eye. And that's symbolizing her ability to help all beings in myriad ways. Sometimes each of those 1,000 hands has an implement in it, and the implement symbolizes a way of helping beings. So my master once referred to her as the ultimate multitasker. Doing 1,000 things at once. I don't think I can compete with that. Now, the way that her compassion functions is actually quite natural. And we can think of her as extraordinary and heroic, and that if we're to imitate her or to embody her. And the point of these beings, by the way, is that they embody some quality which we cultivate in our spiritual practice in some way or another. And I think that embodiment is really important. It's not just something we know about, but something we embody and become. And we can think that to embody her, the deeds we need to do are heroic. You know, let's go save the world, let's stop hunger in Africa, whatever, you know, you're save the environment, whatever it is that we feel is the important thing to do in order to help. But she is spoken of as helping, like reaching back in your sleep to grab your pillow and put it back under your head. Something you do almost instinctively without even being aware of it. You know, it's not self-conscious help. It's just doing what one naturally does. And when the heart and mind are aware, and you know, the process of meditation brings this kind of awareness, we naturally act compassionately. We naturally act in a way that helps beings. And I'm seeing some puzzled looks. Does that make sense to everyone? Okay. And I actually want to read to you one description of her, because I thought it was interesting, and the way that it's put, I find interesting. It says, her compassion is not cradling, cuddling, clasping to the bosom, but rather a function of her ability to see with clarity. She does not shelter, house, or enclose, but rather is about attaining a way of being in the world unbound by any position or fixed attachment. What makes this affirmation of the feminine distinctly Buddhist is the rejection of an exclusive bipolarity or dichotomy between the traits identified as feminine and masculine. It's a non-dual view of gender. And it's that non-dual view which makes the view Buddhist. Now, in reading this, I don't mean to imply that cradling, cuddling, or clasping to the bosom is problematic in any way. It's not, and that's often a form of compassion or kindness or tenderness that we offer that's very helpful. And sheltering, housing, and enclosing isn't, there's nothing wrong with that either. You know, women are often thought of as safe harbors, and I think that's a very positive image of the feminine that we all share to some extent. But it says that she doesn't shelter, house, or enclose, but rather is about attaining a way of being in the world unbound by any position or fixed attachment. Now that has to do with what we were talking about this morning. Now I want to, before I follow that line of thought, I want to throw into the pot here that one of the teachings of Buddhism is that all acceptance is the key to the gateless gate. All acceptance is what we practice in meditation. You know, as I described it this morning, when we sit in meditation and we just sit with whatever's there and we don't try to change it or fix it, this is the practice of all acceptance. It's not saying it's fine. It's not saying I like it. And it's not saying it's okay. You know, if somebody rapes your daughter, it's not okay. But there is a way we can bring all acceptance to it. And that all acceptance is what opens up the space. And within that all acceptance, we can choose skillful means. We can act wisely rather than in reaction to what's happening. So all acceptance is the most compassionate thing that one can do. That's a Buddhist teaching. And what that is, and if you think about it, think about yourself. You, something really lousy is going on in your life, and you go to talk to a friend about it. When the friend just listens and hears you and doesn't turn away from you, that can be the best thing that they can offer you. It can be the most healing thing they can offer you. It can be, that can be an expression of very, very deep compassion. So it's not a matter of, again, of heroics. It's just a simple willingness to be with what is. Now, so if we take that all acceptance and we bring it into this notion of compassion as a way of being in the world unbound by any position or fixed attachment, you know, that's what we were talking about with emptiness, the wisdom of emptiness, is not taking a fixed position, not attaching and grabbing on to something so that it becomes fixed and unchanging. So that leads us back to this meaning of her name, Kanjizai, contemplating self-existence and realizing freedom and perceiving its emptiness. So what I'm saying here doesn't stand against our understanding of compassion as doing something to help someone, like cleaning out a friend's refrigerator when they're at the hospital with their son, you know, or whatever those practical, direct actions are that we take to help beings. But ultimately, what we're talking about is an understanding of emptiness and putting that understanding into practice. And what that looks like is this quality of all acceptance. This quality of allowing things to be as they are. Now that doesn't stand against changing things, and that's a whole other conversation we can have. That doesn't mean you can't see that there's a problem somewhere and do something about that problem. But it begins with this open spaciousness that accepts things as they are and sees them as they are and sees them as they are with clarity. And from that seeing, then responds to them. Now, I want to try to illustrate this a little bit. The wisdom of Prajnaparamita, emptiness or shunyata, and compassion, what Guan Yin embodies, are known as the two pillars of the Mahayana. I said this earlier, they're the two most important things on which Mahayana Buddhism is constructed or based. They're the central focuses of our practice. Now, meditation encompasses all of this, So we're speaking within the context of our meditation practice. So I had this thought that that wisdom and compassion, they're described as the two pillars of the Mahayana. In a sense, that's a somewhat male way of describing them, and I don't mean that in the negative senses of male. He's laughing already. There's no pejorative in that. It's just that you've got these two separate things that are strong, you know, supporting a building. And I was thinking about their relationship to each other, the notion of a Mobius strip came to me. That we could, with the idea of a Mobius strip, we could bring these two pillars together. We're going to have very wobbly pillars here. But do you all know what a Mobius strip is?
No.
Okay. This is something I learned as a kid, and it's become for me almost a description of spiritual training. You have a piece of paper, and it's a strip of paper. It's different on the two sides so that you know which side is which. Now, if you take this piece of paper and you form a circle with it, but when you form the circle, you do a half turn. So the ends come together like this, and you've got this twist in it. And I'm going to take this together because it's going to help me deal with this. So this is a Mobius strip. And the reason that kids learn about Mobius strips, I mean, and if you all have your own experiences with them, I'd like to hear it, but what they show you how to do is you take a pen or pencil, take your magic marker, and you draw a line down the middle. You say you start on this white side here. And you draw your line down the middle, and you keep going around like that, and you keep going, and you find yourself at some point on the colored side of the paper, the pattern side of the paper. You keep going, drawing this line along the paper, and you come back to the white, and you haven't lifted your pen from the paper. So this twist in the paper allows you to draw this continuous line on both sides of the paper without lifting your pen. Now, to me, what happens with emptiness and compassion is exactly this, that we sit down in meditation, and we're, in effect, practicing emptiness. We're not holding on, we're not pushing away, we're sitting at that still point in the center when we can. Easier said than done. But so meditation is sitting in that still point in the center. Now, I hope this example isn't too crude for you, but we're sitting there. Now, I can get this idea that, wow, meditation, that's the ultimate. I'm just going to sit here. I'm going to be like the Buddha. I'm going to sit under this tree until I attain enlightenment. You know, and I sit down in the morning, and I'm going along, and I'm meditating happily, or not, but I'm meditating, and I'm there for an hour, and then I'm there for 2 hours, and then I'm there for 3 hours, and then I have to go to the bathroom. And so my knee's hurting too, you know. So my resolve to sit there is, I'm getting distracted, you know. I really have to go to the bathroom. So eventually I get up and go to the bathroom, right? Or I get up and I eat. Or I get up and I sleep. I lie down and I sleep. Or what I'm trying to say here is that this ideal of sitting still in meditation isn't the wholeness of our lives. You know, I mean, meditation subsumes our life and holds all of it. But there's also the life that we live. So there's the stillness of meditation, but then there's the action of our life. And we bring that stillness of meditation. If the white is the meditation, we bring that stillness into the action of our life. And then out of that action, we return to the stillness. And this can happen in one-hour sequences or split-second sequences. You know, we're constantly moving back and forth between those two, and one, in effect, generates the other. You know, they don't stand against each other. They aren't opposites. They actually contain each other, and they generate each other. So out of the still place of meditation, what is good to do arises naturally. And we can rely on that arising. Just like in the middle of the night, we pull our pillow into position under our heads without even, we don't have to sit there and think, okay, now what's good to do? If we're sitting still, what's good to do will naturally arise. And as we take the next step of what's naturally arising, we gradually find the aspect of stillness within the action. And we return to meditation, either by sitting down on our cushions or chairs, or by bringing the mind into meditation as we do what we're doing. And we talk in our tradition about every minute meditation, having the mind and heart in the mind of meditation, no matter what we're doing, so that we can bring the stillness of meditation and the all acceptance of meditation to everything we're doing. So that's how the all acceptance that we're practicing in meditation becomes the ultimate form of compassion. But our heroic, compassionate acts return us to stillness. Sounds like the coffee's brewing. See, it arises naturally. So what that means is that prajnaparamita becomes, kind of transforms, transmutes into guanyin, and guanyin transmutes into prajnaparamita. And these two come and go within each other constantly in the course of our lives. Now, there's one other... There's an expression of this that we refer to all the time in our own tradition. I don't know how many of you will be familiar with this, but we have what we call the Bodhisattva vow. There's actually four Bodhisattva vows, but I want to talk about one of them, just very briefly, as an expression of this integration of wisdom and compassion, or emptiness and compassion. The Bodhisattva vow is, I vow to become Buddha in order to save all beings. So the idea of that is that one fully supports one's own spiritual life, and by doing so, helps all beings. Now, the truth of this vow is you can't do one or the other. It's kind of like if there's a net, and each being, if we can divide ourselves up into beings, is on a node of the net. And so I'm on one of the nodes of this net, and I decide I'm going to become a Buddha. So I take a step towards becoming a Buddha. Well, the whole net has to come with me. So there's that aspect of it. Another aspect of it is that there aren't any beings to save, because we're empty of self-existence. We aren't actually separate individual beings. We're all interconnected. The third aspect of it is there's no beings to save because we're all already Buddha. So who needs saving, And then there's also that problematic aspect where we get into saving others instead of kind of taking care of our own karma and our own side of the street. So this vow has a lot of different aspects to it and teachings to it. But the reason I've mentioned it is because in my own mind, the I vow to become Buddha part is what prajnaparamita teaches us. And the in order to save all beings part is what Guanyin teaches us. So again, the two of them come together in this vow. I think that the other thing about these two is they express the all is one and the all is different. Reverend Master Jiu, our founder, taught us that enlightenment is being able to recognize that all is one and all is different simultaneously. Now simultaneously, all is one and all is different. And we all have times when we're very much in touch and connected to that sense of all is one. And the all is different is obvious in this room. Each of us is a different being. And to me, prajnaparamita represents that all is one. And Guanyin represents the always different in the particularity of her actions, you know, in the way that she chooses actions in order to help beings. Now, that all is one and all is different is also, I think, a really valid description of how gender works in Buddhism, in that we're different genders, but we're all within the one whole. And those two aspects of gender, male and female, and we could say that there are more than just those two, come together to create a whole and, in effect, need each other or help and support each other. So, to me, it was an extraordinary discovery, as I said earlier in the day, to discover Prajnaparamita and discover that there was a being who is referred to as the mother of the Buddhas, from whom all the Buddhas emanate, to bring together with her Guanyin, and in some sense join male and female together and use that as an exploration into how, what supports and helps us as women, or the feminine aspect of our maleness, what in that supports us and helps us in our training. So I see these two embodiments of wisdom and compassion as inspiration for us, as I said earlier, as a way of uplifting us in a sense from whatever inadequacy, insufficiency, or doldrums we might get into as we train and practice. And in practicing with them and understanding, we begin to discover how male becomes female and female becomes male, in a sense just like this Mobius strip goes from, you know, turns it from one side into the other. And I think I will stop there.